You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a sunny Davis day. It is summer. It is wonderful. I am having a good time. How are you doing, Don?
Well, a year ago on this date, we were embarking on an epic heat wave here in the Sacramento Valley. It began on July 2nd, I believe it was. And for the next 10 days, it was at or over 100 degrees. And then we had a little brief lull, and then we went to another long heat wave. So pretty much the entire month of July 2024 felt like one long heat wave. There were a couple of days of break in there, but it didn't seem like very much. The weather that we're embarking on for this July 2025, as Lois and I are on July 2nd, preparing this for broadcast on July 3rd, happy 4th of July, everybody, is going to be mild, pleasant, balmy. I don't know how many other good adjectives I could throw on to the following temperatures.
The day 90. Most people in the world, that would be huge. And for us, oh, that's balmy.
Oh, it's wonderful. Thursday is going to be 89 degrees. Our average high this time of year is 93, just for the record, average high. But it's also the time of year when we're likeliest to have a very high temperature episode. If we're going to have one, is usually sometime in the first 2 to 3 weeks of July. Those are some of the very memorable ones, like 2024. Thursday night will only be 55 degrees. Independence Day will be 83 degrees and sunny. Friday night will be 52 degrees and clear. Saturday, 88 degrees and sunny. Let me back up there, 52 degrees. Where my kid lives, in one of the major metropolitan areas of the United States, the biggest metropolitan area of the United States, it didn't get below 80 a couple nights ago. Yeah, that's uncomfortable. Yeah, we're going to be just barely above 80 on the 4th of July. It's cooling off back there. They're going into thunderstorms now. Friday night will be 52. Saturday, 88 degrees and sunny. Saturday night, 54 degrees and clear. Sunday, also 88 degrees and sunny. I don't need to say the and sunny part. That's just a given for the next couple months. Sunday night, clear, 54 degrees. Monday, 89. Monday night, 56. Tuesday, 91. And then we appear to be heating up a little bit after that. Tuesday, according to Weather Underground, 93. Wednesday, 97. Thursday, 100. Friday, the 11th, 100. Interestingly, though, this has been predicted, and then it doesn't quite happen. The coastal influence.
The predictions change.
The coastal influence has been
lower.
The coastal influence has been stronger each time that they think the dome is going to build over us and be very uncomfortable. Just for the record, technically, Davis, using the weather station west of town, has not even hit 100 degrees. Woodland did, Winters did, Dixon did. So let's go ahead and say we did two or three times, once or twice in late May. And a few days ago, we also got very close, 98, 99 degrees. But generally speaking, by the first week of July, we've been over 100 at least a couple times, and we're going into our hottest time of year. Well, for the next week, it's going to be lovely. People are gardening. People are still coming in looking for tomato plants and things like that. So our more common question, as our usual brief discussion of vegetables at this time of year. Is it too late for this? Is it, you know, what can we do now? Yeah, there's still things you can plant. You can certainly put in tomato plants. I would focus on smaller fruited types. Peppers are fine. Squash and cucumbers are fine. Pretty much the end of it for melons, because you got 80, 90 days before they'll ripen. So you look at your calendar and go, that's getting a little tight. But you still can plant a lot of things. And you can plant basil, and you can do successive plantings of beans and successive plantings of corn and cucumbers and things like that. A cucumber plant will produce about 3 to 4 weeks after you plant it. So that's something you can continue to put in. The problem will be finding nice, healthy nursery stock for those things, because most places that sell vegetables have dumped them. They're going through, they're throwing things out. They might have a handful of things left, many of them rather overgrown. Try to look for healthy plants if you can. And the one category where I'd be real careful, and I have to give credit to my old friend Debbie Flower for this one, because she mentions this on Fred Hoffman's radio show all the time. Don't buy overgrown members of Cucurbitaceae. Okay? If you take one lesson away from her many visits on the Get Growing with Farmer Fred show, overgrown pumpkins, overgrown melons, overgrown cucumbers that are flowering and trying to fruit right in the pot, they're not going to take well. Look for nice, young, healthy plants, or even plant some seed directly in the ground rather than buying that overgrown half-price clearance item at the hardware chain that still has them out there. So look for healthy plants. Yes, there are things you can plant. And what the heck, you can pivot now to starting Brussels sprouts. It's July. So we never stop gardening here in the Sacramento Valley. Great weather ahead. Maybe going to hit 100 degrees in about a week, possibly. We'll see.
So even though it has been cooler this year than it was last year, remember that we started out with soil that was very dry because we didn't get the winter rains that we usually get. So if you've got bushes and trees and things, make sure you are giving them enough water.
This is a good time to start doing deep soakings if you haven't already on your bigger trees. Low water trees in our area benefit from a very thorough deep soaking once a month. These are trees known to be reasonably drought tolerant. Intermediate water trees, and I could go through a whole list, but maybe we'll do that on another show, every 2 weeks. Higher water things, Japanese maples, birches, magnolias, probably every 7 to 10 days. But when I say that, I mean a really thorough soaking, 18 inches deep if you possibly can. So that means a long, slow soak, not 10 minutes with your sprinklers. But right now is a good time to start that if you haven't already, giving the bigger plants, the woody plants, the shrubs and trees, a very thorough soaking. Many of the pictures I'm looking at as people bring them in are either younger plants they weren't watering sufficiently because they just aren't that well established yet, or older plants that are finally reaching the point where a good deep soaking is necessary, not just the lighter, shallower watering that we constantly find ourselves talking with people about. This week example, how are you watering? Twice a week for 7 minutes with a drip system? Wow, that's like a coffee cup of water per plant. So we go back to watering 101 very commonly. And you know, okay, I don't want to make fun of people. All of us started somewhere. The first garden I had was in coastal San Diego, but it was on a foot of topsoil, which is just basically sand, that was sitting on sandstone. If you know the coastal parts of Southern California, it's generally cliffs and mesas and things. And there's no real soil there. And so the neighborhood was subdivided, and my dad brought in a foot of something that we would call topsoil. I had to water 2 to 3 times a week in a climate where it's rarely above 72 degrees because the water would just run through, hit the sandstone below, run off into my neighbor's yard. I was quite accustomed to him leaning over the fence and going, "Hey, Don, water's coming in my..." "Oh, yeah, turned off, thank you." Because we had nothing but a foot of essentially potting soil. So I understand that learning how to water is very local, very regional, very hyper-local. I mean, within Davis, a common question I'll ask people while they're talking about watering is, "What part of town do you live in?" Yeah. And they look a little confused. And I say, well, the soils differ. So if you're in Stonegate, West Davis, if you're up in North Davis, you've got heavier soil. You have to water differently than if you're in the fine sandy loam of southern South Davis or the intermediate silty loams of East Davis. And that's just within a little tiny city, much less the whole breadth of, say, Southern California or all the parts of up and down the valley. So learning how to water is not something that we should take for granted. You need to ask locally. I moved to a new area. It's not going to happen. But if I moved to a new area, first thing I would do is identify all the trees. Second thing I do is go find a soil map and figure out what the soils are like. And then I'd go ask the folks about how you water and how you manage this kind of soil. Those would be the two most important things once I know which USDA zone I'm in to know how to garden in that area. Because what kind of soil you're on is going to determine how you water. I had to water more often in a mild climate than I have to here. Why? Not because it's hotter here. Our ET rate is 20, 30% higher here than what I was gardening in there. But the soils here will hold moisture, so we can water differently.
So if listeners are trying to figure out how to get Don to learn about your town, ain't going to happen. He's not moving away from here to there.
I'll learn about your soil. That's fine.
Look around your area and find out if you have some expert or some resource where you can find out more about the soils in your town.
But you can also type into your Google search engine, UCD soil map, and up will come this amazing soils map from, I believe, the entire state of California, especially well detailed for the agricultural regions where we are, hosted by the UC Davis Land, Air, and Water Resources Department. So I'm not going to read the whole URL to you, just UC Davis soil map. And it will show you, it's right in front of me right here. And I'm looking at, you know, these squiggles of lines showing all the different soil types. It does lapse into jargon as you click on them and learn about what your actual soil is, but it does give you some information about drainage and soil type. And it's a really good starting point. So if you are somewhere, especially in the agricultural parts of California, but I believe it covers most of the heavily urbanized areas, are a challenge for them because the soils have been so changed. But if you're in anything that's that is a fairly recent city, you might say, or is agricultural in the general region, you'll get a lot of information from this UC Davis soils map. UCD soils map will get you where you're going. You can at least start with that and then talk to folks in the cooperative extension about what your soils are like. The main thing you need to know, how quickly does water go into the soil? And that's the infiltration rate. And how well does it retain moisture? Those are probably the key characteristics that will tell you whether you need to water slowly or you can water more quickly, and how much water you can put on all at once. And that was a big digression from the weather. KDRT is community radio. We're public radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. So if you like what you hear and all these digressions, just go to kdrt.org and click on the, let's see, the support button, I believe it is. Well, you're over there. Read about all the really cool programming here. Let me see. There was one show I wanted to mention because there's always new shows coming on. And we've got producer John Emery is doing a show called That California Sound from Then to Now, featuring local, regional, and small touring bands throughout California, highlighting the history and the culture of California musicians, venues, teachers, recording studios, promoters, festivals, and general resources that enrich our community. That California Sound from Then to Now is Mondays, 6 to 8 p.m. There's a podcast link available, and all the music shows here rebroadcast at some point. So for the rebroadcast time by John Emery and Scott Schiller, you can just look at the schedule guide.
I got an email message from a fellow here in town, Joe, and it was so nice. He wrote to my That's Life email address, and he said how much he enjoyed my show and thanked me for doing it. And that was wonderful. Don, you met Joe, didn't you?
I've known Joe off and on for years. He's been living in the Davis area and also elsewhere in California, and has been listening to the Davis Garden Show podcast, I think, since its inception, which was 2005. So that's a long time listener there. I know there's a lot of you out there that have been listening for quite a while. And just always great to talk to you folks when you stop by the nursery and say hi. And with your permission, I will greet you on the air. So Joe, thanks for listening and thanks for stopping by.
Okay. Next is a question from Peggy, who says, hi Don, this monster weed has shown up in my next garden area to be renovated. I've whacked several times, but it seems to come taller with larger leaves each time. I haven't come across this before in the garden. As usual, once I know what it is, I'll use it for an MG teachable moment. Master Gardener.
Yeah, yes. It's funny, I'll just describe this. It's a very lush looking plant that comes up, and it fools everybody at least once if you're a gardener, thinking, did I plant something there? That looks like a whatever, celosia or something else, amaranth. That looks like something I would have planted. And then it flowers. And this is probably the most common question requesting plant identification on plant ID, Facebook groups, and so forth. Phytolacca americana, American pokeweed, or poke salad, or pokeberry, or dragonberries, or pigeonberry, or inkberry. Those are all from Wikipedia, and there's probably 20 other common names for this plant. It's an attractive plant. The flowers are pretty, and pollinators and stuff do visit them. The fruit is very attractive, and birds love the berries, so they scatter it about, according to Wikipedia. Gray cat birds. Do we have gray cat birds here?
No, we do not.
Okay. Northern mockingbird?
Eastern only.
How about northern mockingbird?
Yes, we do.
Okay. Northern
yes.
Cardinals? And brown thrashers,
nope,
apparently.
That's
all.
Nope,
brown thrashers? Brown thrashers?
Nope. Nope.
Nope. Okay. Well, of all those, the northern mockingbirds apparently like them, and I'm sure other things do too. They're poisonous.
Love Jays here.
It's one of those plants that's poisonous but eaten. Early in the season, in spring and early summer, with proper cooking, parts of the plant are edible. And they're in the south, southeastern United States, people do eat them, poke salad. But you got to know how to cook them, because in the summer they become deadly. And the berries are also poisonous. So be aware of that. And birds are scattering it all over our area. Any place that it gets introduced, it quickly spreads all over the place. Coming up from seed, very recognizable seedling, once I have given you the name and you've looked it up and you recognize it, so you would probably do best to pull it out. And this is a case where pulling it out will be necessary, because it can resprout very readily. And in our climate, the plant actually can be perennial. In many places, it functions only as an annual. So it's an attractive plant. We all think the first time we see it that it's something we put in. It's not. It's, you know, it's not a major nuisance in your yard. I've never seen a yard overtaken by it, but it is scattering itself quite a bit, and it would be best if we perhaps would not allow that to happen because of the toxicity, among other issues. I would think with sufficient critical mass at some point of seed germination, you could get a lot of it in one place. It's come up on my farm every year. I have one out in my vegetable garden that I just noticed the other day. Again, it was down at the end. It was an area where I thought I'd planted something. I have some celosia coming up on its own down there. Whoops, that one's not celosia. I better pull that one out. So poke salad, Phytolacca americana, very attractive plant, but invasive and definitely toxic.
You have given only one species name for this poke salad weed. Is it only one species, or there are a number of poke weeds?
There are a number of members of the genus Phytolacca, but the only one we're dealing with here is Phytolacca americana, the American poke wheat. There's one that's native to South America. There's one that's native to Chile. They're all over the Americas, but in particular, we just deal with this one, Phytolacca americana.
All right. Well, let's see what else we've got here. We have a question. A request, actually, and this is from Josh, and it says, hello there, garden gurus. I'm looking for a cheerful pink flowering vine to climb this pergola above my garage. See photo attached. The front of the house faces northwest, so it gets a nice afternoon sun in and summer, but no direct sunlight in the winter. I'm a bit worried a rose would not do well here due to the lack of sunlight in the winter. I considered Clematis armandii, but my wife is not a fan of white flowers. Okay. So here's the question. Any pink flowering vines you recommend for these conditions? Would planting a vine here even be advisable long-term? I'm thinking about wood and moisture and pruning and that. And bonus points if it attracts pollinators or smells amazing. Thanks in advance and happy growing. And Josh lives in Davis.
Yeah, now, this is a West Basin.
Let me describe the photo here. Because when I first saw it, I thought they were talking about the overhang that's way up on the second story. No. Just in front of the two-car garage, there is a fairly short expanse. And I'm guessing that can't be more than 3 or 4 feet.
Yeah.
And it's a structure that it's got posts on the side. It's attached to the house. And then there are wooden cross beams, I guess you'd call them, going out, pointing towards the street. So
yeah, and there's only
fairly well constrained
sturdy area. Yes, very sturdy. That's a key element here. It is sturdy. It's there's gaps between this is really important. There's gaps between the cross pieces on top where you could get up if you had to with a ladder and do some pruning, because that's really important. Any vine is going to require seasonal or at least every couple of years some pruning to keep it from going up onto the roof and from getting into the gutters and things like that. So make sure this is a place, and it looks like it would be, where you could get up on, say, a 6 or 8 foot ladder and prune it away from the rest of the building and get rid of the tangle, because no matter what kind of vine you plant, there'll be a tangle. And some of them get to be quite a mess up there, like Passiflora. I wouldn't do something like that. It would just overwhelm the spot. Others are great big woody plants that would require that you do this kind of maintenance, or else they could actually do some damage. Like Wisteria is a good example. Very heavy, very sturdy vine that I'm always concerned that people aren't going to give it enough a room and won't keep it under control.
I should say that the shingles are not wooden shingles. This right. is This is like that stone stuff.
Yes. So that's good. That reduces the problem. But still, you got to keep the vine from insinuating itself in there and you know, doing damage to your house. So that is a reasonable concern. You basically have a typical choice between soft, lush vegetative vines that have only green wood or semi-hardwood, jasmines and things like that, and woody vines like grapes and wisterias, and then things like roses, which we're often training as if they were vines. Grapes and wisterias would overwhelm this spot. So those wouldn't be my first choice. The Clematis armandii that you mentioned isn't, you know, it grows vigorously. In fact, in the Pacific Northwest, it's considered, I guess, invasive. It's a very vigorous plant. It would overwhelm this. It's kind of sparse in terms of its habit, and it's gets a little burnt here. It's not really thrilled about our high temperatures and low humidity. So I would steer you away from that one anyway. Clematis in general would be fine there, except that there's a lot of vigorous growth on the deciduous types of Clematis. So it would be something you'd be training, tucking, keeping it up there, enjoying the bloom, cutting it down every year. So there would definitely be, there would be seasonal maintenance required. The one group of Clematis that wouldn't be as much maintenance would be Clematis montana. And they're more heat tolerant, more drought tolerant. They bloom very early. They are pink or white, pale pink, medium pink or white. They smell like vanilla, wonderful fragrance, like a vanilla cake. And they're actually quite tough and adaptable. They bloom on new wood, not new growth. And so there's some jargon for you. New wood is what grew last year. So this year it's wood. Last year it was growth. This year it's wood. So you have to let it grow onto the structure. Then you enjoy the bloom. And in our climate here in Davis, they bloom February to March. So one of the very early blooms, and the fragrance is wonderful. Then when it's done blooming, so this makes them really easy, you cut it back as hard as you want. You can take it all the way to the ground if you want to, or you can take it back to the framework of your overhang. It'll take a year or two to get up there, but you could then get up on a ladder after the bloom. And this is not complicated. It doesn't require any degree in horticulture. You're just grabbing handfuls of this overgrown thing and cutting it back to either your basic framework or the post or even the ground if for some reason you wanted to do that. You don't prune it like you do all the other Clematis, which bloom on new growth. You do those, the Jack Manny hybrids, the Tangutica hybrids, the ones that you're probably familiar with. You can cut them to the ground. And then when they come up, about the 1st of March on my property, mid-February, the 1st of March, you got to make a decision real quickly about where it's going to go. In your case, it's obvious, but you're going to need to retrain it each year to get up there. Yeah. So the regular Clematis would be more work than the Clematis montana. And usually people are looking for Clematis or Clematis montana Rubens, which has the pinker flower. So if you like that group, it's a great plant. They're deciduous. They're spectacular bloom very early in the season. I'll mention two others, and then I'll refer you to a couple of resources on this. Pandoria jasminoides. Jasminoides is the species name for a whole lot of vines. Jasmine,
just means like jasmine.
Oides just means like, and jasmine. So jasminoides just means like jasmine. So we have potato vine, Solanum jasminoides. We have the one I just mentioned, Pandoria. Is another one. It's not a jasmine. It's actually in the trumpet vine family, but it actually sort of looks like a jasmine, at least in the sense that it's a vine. It's got a nice smell, sweet fragrance. It's the kind where you have to kind of go up to the flower to smell it. So it's not going to drift all over and be fragrant at your front door, but it's there and it's very pretty. And there's also a white version. So Pandoria jasminoides. In our climate, it sometimes frosts back a little bit, usually not, and it comes back with no problem and blooms off and on through the summer. I mentioned it's in the trumpet vine family, but don't let that deter you. It's not a rampant trumpet vine. If you think about trumpet vines and you're serious about them, send me a note and I'll talk you out of them because they spread by underground suckers. This is in the family, but it doesn't do that. So it's a very well-mannered member of Bignoniaceae of the trumpet vine family. And if you really like jasmine and you want one that has a pleasant fragrance, although strong, Jasminum polyanthum, which is called pink jasmine. It's called that because the buds are pink. They open white. So it's a white-flowered pink-budded jasmine called pink jasmine. Jasminum polyanthum is a very vigorous jasmine, but it's all herbaceous. It doesn't make a big woody stem or trunk or anything like that. And so it's a very vigorous vine that will quickly scramble up onto this thing. And once every probably 2 years, you'll need to get up on a ladder and essentially shear it back to the framework. So it would take some maintenance as far as that goes. It's powerfully fragrant in April, sweet, strong, pleasant smell. Most people like jasmine polyanthum, at least in limited doses. It's far enough from your front door and your windows that I don't think you're going to be overwhelmed by it. This is not star jasmine, which you could use, but be aware that star jasmine is pretty overpowering to some people. This is strong, fragrant, but it is not that overwhelming. What's overwhelming is it's a very vigorous vine. So you'd be planting it on the one post. It'll scramble up that. It'll go across the top. 2 to 3 years in, it'll look spectacular. And then every year or so, you'll need to get up and shear it back to the basic framework. Or if you get tired of that, yank the whole thing down, cut it off at ground level, and let it resprout. You could certainly do that. So the three that I mentioned, Clematis montana rubens, Pandorea jasminoides, and Jasminum polyanthum.
So I have a couple of questions here. What about Hardenbergia? Isn't that a vine that would work on this, or is it too strong?
It's purple. A couple things about Hardenbergia. This is the lilac vine. Happy Wander is the best known one. Many of us have observed it's a 5 to 7 year plant. We were selling them vigorously. You know, they bloom in the winter, royal purple, color that sells itself. I could just put them out and they'd sell all day long from January through March when they're in bloom. They are hardy enough to grow here. We wondered about that when it first came on the market because some of the Hardenbergias are a little more frost tender. Major freeze events have damaged Hardenbergia, Happy Wander, sometimes just damaging the flower buds as they were forming. So that's disappointing. We've all, as landscapers and nursery people, had this experience that 5 or 6 years in, it just dies out. So you need a quick cover for a fence or something, it's a great choice. You'll say you're planting a hedge, but you're impatient. You want to screen your neighbors out. You want the hedge to grow. You chose something that only grows a couple feet a year. Hardenbergia on the fence behind it will grow great for 5 or 6 years, just about the time your hedge plants are getting up there. Seems almost like clockwork, the Hardenbergia will start to die out. Nothing you did, it's not overwatering or anything. They just seem to have a lifespan. So I have no problem recommending it as long as you know that. And it also is, I only didn't think of it because it's not pink. So that was
well, an issue. You say it's a dark purple, but I had one that was lavender. Are there variations?
Yes, there are. There's two species that are out there, and it's a little confusing. Although, again, the difference between purple and lavender is a subjective thing as well. Let me tell you, I can tell you from considerable experience, people have different definitions for what is purple, what is blue. A customer in the nursery was looking at a Nepeta called Blue Wonder. She'd come in, she'd call, "Do you have any blue Nepeta?" That's the cat mint, folks. "And yeah, we've got several all the time. We always have several." And she walks in, she's looking, "That's not blue." I said, "Okay, let me tell you something about the nursery industry. If it's even close to blue, we call it blue. If it's even metaphorically blue, we call it blue." And she picks up, she turns to the person next to her, who she was a complete stranger, goes, "Does this look blue to you?" He goes, "No, it looks purple." Okay, no. So we sold her something else. So first of all, Lois and I may disagree on the difference between purple and lavender, but I agree there is some variation just by localized climate. And there is another species out there that is sold pretty commonly, Hardenbergia comptoniana, more widely planted in the Bay Area. I knew a landscaper down there who actually preferred it because he felt it was a better looking plant, but it's tender. If I were using sunset zones, I would say 15 to 24 for that one, whereas Happy Wander, yeah, will grow at 8, 9, and 14. Basically, what I just said was Comptoniana only goes to about 30 degrees. Happy Wander go to about 25. We get to 25. You know, it does happen. So, and it's a lighter, bluer color and a very attractive vine, which you can probably find in nurseries in the San Francisco Bay Area. But Josh is from Davis. So Hardenbergia would be a thought, but I think it would not be suitable in this particular location. Those are the three that I've mentioned. Now, if you want to go look up a bunch of stuff about vines, my business website, redwoodbarn.com, there's What Grows Here is a link over on the table, and there's a bunch of lists there. These are lists that I simply generated from a database, so they're not, you know, put together as a beautiful presentation. It's several pages long. It's got a whole lot of vines on it. And my experience with these lists is that people tend to get a little overwhelmed because of the number of choices. But scroll through that. And as you go through it, if there's any that catch your eye or interest you, send us notes about them. And this is important. My worst garden mistakes on my farm have all involved roses and vines. Not bamboo, not anything else. The roses and vines have been my worst mistakes. Choosing a rose that suckers and covers a huge territory that I didn't know was going to do that, and vines that are just taken over and sent out suckers and climbed up onto things and become a nightmare. So I don't want you all planting things that are going to become really high maintenance. I see a place here where there's a relatively small pergola and a relatively small planting zone for it. So let's choose something well-mannered. The three that I mentioned, I think, would be suitable. It might might be that you'll see something in there that intrigues you. There is a pink flowered wisteria, for example, and it's pretty readily available. It's called Caroline, and it's pink flowered. It's a pink version of Chinese wisteria. We'll have a talk about wisteria and how big and substantial a vine they are and the maintenance that goes into that, but it might be something that intrigues you as you're reading through the list. So that's redwoodbarn.com, right there on the homepage, what grows here, and you'll find all sorts of lists in there with varying degrees of aptitude with respect to how they're put forward and presented by me, because I'm not an expert on that kind of thing.
So we're in Davis. And would bougainvillea work at his in that situation, or is it too exposed?
It would work there. It's, as we've discussed with subtropicals, it's getting it through that first winter. That's always the challenge. This is against the house. There's an overhang provided by the structure it's going to grow on and the house nearby. West is not perfectly optimal for these plants that are a little marginal here. South, southeast would be better, but the concrete nearby, the driveway nearby, that building there and the overhang would probably protect it. Bougainvillea is certainly a possibility. Having grown up with bougainvilleas in virtually every yard that I gardened in as a teenager and being the one who had to prune them, they are thorny. Please be aware of that when you're planting it. And they can be very uncomfortable to prune. They do need to be pruned. They're a big woody plant that's not actually a vine. So you're tying it up there. It's a big sprawling giant ground cover, basically. And that's true of a lot of plants. They aren't really a true vine in the sense of twining on something or holding themselves on with tendrils. No, it's just this big floppy thing. And so you grow it and you tie it up and then you tie it over the top. That would be extremely elegant. And what I would look for is one of the ones that is vigorous. There's a lot of bougainvilleas coming on the market right now that are dwarf, and you don't want those. You would want, I'll list them real quickly, Barbara Karst or San Diego Red or Brasiliensis. Those are the three that I would look for. Barbara Karst is magenta. San Diego Red is magenta with more orange to it, and Brasiliensis is purple. And so those three.
None of those are pink, Don.
I know.
I've seen pink bougainvillea.
I know. The pink one is more dwarf, so that would not be optimal. And the reason for that is when we do get cold, these get killed back. And they come back, and the vigorous ones come back quickly, whereas the more dwarf ones just don't come back as well. So if you do go in the direction of a bougainvillea, I'd probably look for one of those three. You can certainly try the lighter pink ones, but they take a while to get up to the top of this structure, and they wouldn't be as optimal. Bougainvillea would work. That would be a classic in Southern California for sure. And they do work here, as long as you get them through that first winter. I had to plant 4 1-gallon bougainvilleas in sequence before I finally got one through the first winter, because I'm out in the country and I'm colder. I think Josh could probably get one through the winter.
Yeah. All right. Well, Josh, I hope you have fun reading these pages and pages and pages of vines. And then I would recommend that you get the genus and species names and put them in the Google looking for images.
Yep.
And see the picture before you write in and talk about stuff.
Yeah.
Look at it. See if that is something that is going to appeal to you, if the flowers are the right size and the right, you know, because like you could want pink flowers that are giant pink flowers, like, I don't know, passion flower or something. Or you can want a delicate little pink flower like.
He did mention roses, and there are climbing roses, but the thing about most of the roses that are sold as climbers, they're actually just tall versions of an existing rose. Many of them are just a sport of a hybrid tea or a grandiflora or something like that. There are some true climbers. The Cecil Bruner rose is a good example, and it's pink. It's a sweetheart rose. It's a lovely rose. It is thorny. So be aware of this when you plant something where you're going to have to prune it. It's a very vigorous climbing rose. It grows to 15 to 20 feet with no problem, and it would be easy to train up onto this. I do want to mention Cecil Bruner, the sweetheart rose. Only blooms in the spring. It doesn't repeat bloom through the summer, which is an interesting phenomenon. Cecil Bruner was the climbing form was a mutant, a variant, a sport, as we call it in the business, that just occurred on the regular bush form of Cecil Bruner. Cecil Bruner rose was a 3 to 4 foot bush with cute little pink flowers, baby pink flowers. They call it the sweetheart rose. It's got a wonderful fragrance to it. This vigorous sport occurred. This happens when you're growing thousands of roses for commercial production. Every now and then, you're taking all these cuttings, one of them will just spontaneously mutate. We call it a sport, and it's much more vigorous. And every now and then, the industry will say, hey, look, a vigorous version of that, I'll bet it would sell as a climber. Well, it does. Very commonly, for reasons that have never been made clear to me, those sports only bloom on new wood. And so when a climbing version of Angel Face came on the market, we all got excited, and then it only bloomed in the spring. Climbing version of Cecil Bruner came on the market, and it only bloomed in the spring, typically. But it's got nice foliage. It's very clean-looking foliage. It's very resistant to diseases. It actually can take a lot of shade, as well as exposures like this one. And it's basically evergreen, is the other thing to know about it. Unlike many roses, which are truly deciduous, a lot of other roses don't, in our climate, actually make an abscission layer and drop their leaves like a proper deciduous plant would. And so you've got foliage there in the winter as well. And it's attractive foliage. It's a nice looking plant, even though you just get the spring bloom. It would be more work to get it up there. It would be more work to keep it there. But if I were choosing a climbing rose, I would probably look at something like the climbing version of Cecil Bruner.
What about that one that I see occasionally called Mandevilla? It's got some pink and it's a
climber. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're talking about this plant a lot. This has become extremely popular with the wholesale growers that sell to hardware stores and to non-nursery plant outlets. So Mandevilla is the common name being applied to things that are in the genus Diplodenia. I think that distinction is still being made by taxonomists, but it could change. If you're lucky enough to live in coastal Southern California, you can grow the old hybrid Mandevilla called Alice DuPont, which was one of my favorite vines when I was gardening down there. Great big flower, true pink color, very well-mannered, nice sweet sort of jasmine-y scent to it, and a wonderful plant, but not hardy anywhere north of Southern California, to my knowledge. But you know what? I've got my Western Garden book right here. Let's see how far north you can grow Mandevilla Alice DuPont. Because it's been a long time.
Is that Mandevilla laxa, or is that?
No, that's a different one. We'll get to that in a moment. That's so Mandevilla Alice DuPont zones 21 to 24. So Southern Californians only. Yes, that's I was in 24. Mandevilla laxa is a Chilean jasmine. Has a wonderful scent. It's the kind. It smells like jasmine, but you have to walk up to it to smell it. So it's not going to overwhelm you. That's better for some people. Maybe better right near a front door in some ways. White flower. Deciduous. So unlike all the other things called Mandevillas, well, that might be good in this case. Unlike all the other things called Mandevillas, which are evergreens, this one is deciduous. It will grow in the shade and it has a jasmine scent. It's called Chilean jasmine, and that's hardy in Northern California. So that's Mandevilla laxa. But what you're seeing at all the stores right now are Diplodenias being sold with the name Mandevilla or Mandevilla on them. They're not hardy here. It frustrates me that they're being sold in the interior here in the valley at well-established garden center chains, as well as the local hardware stores and such. I could, if I would put them out and keep my mouth shut, I could sell dozens of them every summer. Beautiful tubular flowers, flattened tubular flowers, hummingbirds like them. They come in red and pink and white and all kinds of cool shades in between. And
annuals.
Yes, we should basically treat them as annuals. Now, I've been working a lot with a local retirement center where people have all these different microclimates. And there's one group of them there that's very visible, unfortunately, because it's planted in the interior patio, which that's is covered, right, and cascades out into the sun by the sidewalk. So people come in and ask me what this is and can they grow it? I said, well, obviously you can grow it. Your neighbor is growing it, but look at where they have it. They have an east-facing exposure under an overhang. Those have gone through the winter okay. They look a little rough, but they come back each spring. In a normal setting, it's just not hardy here in the valley. So Mandevilla would not be suitable in this particular location. My only concern with this is when people put out these tender plants in garden centers, just put them out there as if they're hardy. Now that bothers me, because if you're planting, let's say, tropical hibiscus or these kinds of Mandevillas, you need to be aware the likelihood of it getting through the winter here is slim. And I understand we have, you know, people are very concerned about climate change and they think that we're warming very rapidly. We are warming in many ways, but not enough for these subtropical plants to make it through the winter here in Northern California. This whole group is being heavily promoted these days because there's some of the bigger breeding companies that have come out with a bunch of new varieties. They're great for a container. You know, it's the kind of thing you should have it in a great big planter, someplace where you can wheel that over closer to the house as we get into the winter. Pretty good chance it'll get through. But I would not personally sell anything labeled Mandevilla as an outdoor plant except Mandevilla laxa, the Chilean jasmine, which is a very different beast.
Okay. Last question about this non-vine on a pergola. So if I have a a plant that is putting out new growth, which is limber. And in nature, it would cascade over and hang down in the canyon and whatever.
Big category, yes.
Yeah. And so if I got one of those plants that was tall enough and then could lay down on top of that pergola, you'd probably have to tie it now and then. But that might work. Abutilon?
Well, you could with some price of abutilon. That wouldn't be my first choice, especially not on a west exposure. But that's a category of plant that we don't really know how to name in the nursery business. These are not vines. Tecomeria capensis, the tachomas, a really good example. And I don't have a common name off the top of my head for that one, but it's derived from the southwestern native. These are great trumpet flowered plants that get tall enough to train as a vine, but if you do nothing, they're just going to flop across the ground or sprawl over nearby shrubs.
Is this Cape honeysuckle?
Cape honeysuckle is Tecomeria capensis. Tecoma stans is a related member of the same family that's been bred heavily, selected for compact growth habit, repeated bloom, and so forth. If you drive by my nursery, Redwood Barn Nursery on 5th Street, you will see that we took one 5 years ago, planted it on the corner of our sign, and trained it all the way up to the top. And last year, we trained it over the top of our sign, which is 10 feet high. And it's a yellow-orange flowered one. There's no pink in that category. There's sort of a darker reddish one, but there's no pink, so I didn't think of it for this particular situation. They've become incredibly popular because you can prune them like a shrub and have them bloom like a shrub. You can train them on a fence and prune them to whatever height you want. They bloom on new growth, so they bloom no matter what you do to them. And if you're patient, they will send up shoots that are long enough to tie up onto a structure such as this pergola, probably the second year that they would do that, maybe the third. And then you can train them out and arch out, and they'll bloom beautifully all summer. So this group, Tecoma, T-E-C-O-M-A, there's a bunch of new ones, and it would work in this setting with a little training on your part. And there's a lot of other plants in this same category. They're not, you know, they're a true vine, either twines or holds on with tendrils. These are things that just sprawl, and then we take advantage of that. Purple potato vine is a good example. Solanum rantanetti, now classed as Lysianthus rantanetti. It's just a big sprawly shrub, but you can train it up and make it into a vine, pretend it's a vine with a little work on your part. So there's a whole other category of plants that can be done that way. One that you'd look at if you're broadening your color selections would be the Tecomerias and Tecomas.
One of our listeners, Gaina, writes and tells us that right now there is a discussion on Nextdoor about Caltrans removing the oleanders in the center divider along I-80.
Yeah.
I hate to see them go. They seem to survive with complete neglect and look great when they bloom. Most people don't like them because they're toxic, but and say that when they burn, the smoke is toxic. What are your thoughts about this? My thought, first of all, is it's the center divider of I-80.
It's likelihood of risk. I would say the risk of toxicity of an oleander in the middle of a freeway is fairly slim. Oleanders, people in California have a love-hate relationship with them. This is about the toughest plant there is. By the way, they don't know even exactly where it's native. This has been so widely planted around the world. You can stick a branch of an oleander in the ground and it'll root. Without any summer irrigation, it will bloom. I mean, how can we argue with that? Well, we can argue with how many thousands of them were planted by Caltrans back in the 50s and 60s, all up and down the freeways, all over California. So a couple of facts about this. One, I don't think Caltrans is taking out oleanders. This was part of a reconstruction project. Yes, they might take them out there. In general, no. But they do prune them. And there was some discussion about how they don't prune them, or they do this or they don't do that. I live along the freeway. I have 1,400 feet of freeway frontage, and there's oleanders out there in the middle. And every few years, I see a lot of lights out there, and they are reducing the traffic on Interstate 80. And they are in the middle of the night. They always do this in the middle of the night because that's when there's least traffic. They have a machine that literally hedges, prunes, and grinds the prunings all at the same time as they go. So this thing goes, it was custom built for Caltrans. It goes over the oleanders, goes down and makes a little cube out of them, slightly rounded. And they just slowly pull it down, and it's just making this incredible grinding noise. And when they get done, they've taken them down by about half, and they've pruned them, and they've taken everything away. So they do prune.
They mulch with the chopped up wood, or do they?
It goes away. Everything that they grind up goes away. I don't know what they do with it, but it goes away. So that's the first thing. Second is, is that they're not planting oleanders anymore, and oleander sales in California, I can tell you as a nursery owner, are practically nil. Hardly anybody grows them, but you really can't argue with a plant that can live without any summer irrigation and gives that much in the way of bloom. There are parts of the state now where they're dying. Southeastern California, the glassy-winged sharpshooter, which is a pest that carries a disease that is really a problem on wine grapes, also carries a disease that kills oleanders. And it's spread all over southern, southeastern California, the desert areas, Riverside County, and so forth, all south of the Tehachapis, for those of you who know our geography. And a quarantine has been in place, affecting nurseries in a big way, since this pest showed up in the early 1990s to keep glassy-winged sharpshooters out of Northern California, because they would affect the wine industry. So that has worked, by the way. Glassy-winged sharpshooter, double quarantine process. If I order something from Southern California, it's inspected before it goes out by the ag commissioner down there. It's inspected at my nursery when it arrives before I'm allowed to sell it. And that has kept glassy-winged sharpshooter out of Northern California. But it's all over Southern California. And what it does, it carries a disease that causes them to die to the ground. They cut them back, they resprout, they die to the ground again. Basically, looks like the plant has fire blight. It's a different disease, but it kills it, kills the top, and then you can, you know, keep mowing them off, but most of them are simply being taken out. So nobody's selling or planting oleanders in Southern California anymore. In the coastal zones, there's a gall that gets on them. It doesn't hurt them, but it disfigures them really badly. So hardly anybody's growing or selling them in the coastal areas. For all my wholesalers, I have two that still have any inventory of oleanders, and they mostly do the dwarf types that are suitable garden plants that get like 4x4. They give the great bloom, and they're completely drought tolerant. So they are tough plants, but you're not seeing them going in anymore. And I don't think Caltrans is actually taking them out. I think that that is a misreading of what they're doing. They're pruning them, and they do prune them back, and they prune them hard every now and then just to reduce the volume of stuff in the middle. They are highly poisonous. Human poisonings with oleander are so rare that they get printed in medical journals because of how unusual they are. It's an extremely low risk of human toxicity or pet toxicity. The risk is livestock. And there was a very famous and very unfortunate poisoning of alpacas west of Davis. Several were killed by grazing on oleander prunings that had been cut off, allowed to drop into the paddock or whatever where the alpacas were, and were left there and not picked up. The alpacas fed on them and were killed by them. So that's terrible when that happens. And it's obviously a livestock concern. But human poisonings by oleander are extremely, extremely rare because it's very, very bitter. As with any other plant that has those glycosides in it, closely related plant is milkweed. Asclepias has the same types of bitter compounds in it. So it's important to know if you're a gardener and you're doing a project with kids for, you know, growing milkweed for monarchs, that plant they're handling is very, very, very poisonous. It's as poisonous as an oleander, basically, and closely related. Which brings us to one other thing about oleander. There's an aphid, really kind of a pretty aphid, golden color. I like it. I think it's kind of cool in its own way, but that's because, you know, I'm raised by a biologist. And it has moved from oleander to milkweed. So any asclepias that you get at a nursery or in your garden is likely to have the oleander aphid on it at some point. And people ask, what do I do about it? Nothing. Don't do anything about it. You certainly don't want to spray it with a pesticide because you're growing the milkweed for monarchs. So you definitely don't want to put any kind of pesticide on them. Many beneficials will come along and take care of the aphid. You can squish them, you can wash them off, or you can just plain not worry about them. But that did move from oleanders. It's an imported, introduced aphid on an imported, introduced plant, moved on to milkweed, native or otherwise. And so it's a very common pest on milkweed as well.
So I have some oleanders on my property. When we bought the house back in the 90s, they were already here and they were already 12 feet tall or whatever. I know exactly that golden aphid you're talking about. I got to tell you that ruby crowned kinglets.
Got it. Okay.
Kinglet. Love those.
Oh, good.
There's a lot of little birds. In the wintertime, we get the yellow-rumped warbler. Oh, they love those. So I'm happy to see them because I know that they're going to feed my little birds.
Yeah.
So
It's hard for me to think of a plant that would meet Caltrans requirements of giving a growing thing along the freeway that blooms and looks pretty that's comparable to the oleander. I mean, zero irrigation in all parts of the state. It's a desert, or it's a desert plant that blooms. There's other fascinating members of Poaceae, which is the family that it's in, and some of them have very showy flowers. Oleander is just a very tough plant. No, they're not planting it anymore, but you know, let's not dump on a plant that's been that successful for us for this long. So far here in the valley, no problems on it. Coastal areas, southeastern California, they're pretty much going away.
So there are four that are on a fence line outside my window on the east side of the house, and I took them down to the ground. I got,
you can do that. Yep.
I, you know, it's like, okay, we just cut them all off, haul off all that wood. It's just not there. Didn't water. Didn't do anything. They have not been irrigated since the 90s. Well, I doubt they were irrigated before that,
yeah.
But I certainly haven't done it. And guess what? They're above the fence again.
They come back very quickly and they get back to full size. Yeah.
Pink and white. That's gorgeous.
The biggest of all is the white one, Sister Agnes, which is actually one of the best if you're actually looking to landscape with oleanders. It's big. The white is bright white, very clean, and it's very, very vigorous. I just consider it one of the best of the group. Not a lot of nurseries with oleanders in stock, but they could probably order them for you if you feel that they're appropriate to your situation. They have been the subject of urban legends for as long as I've been in business. The urban legends about people killed by oleanders, which you simply won't find any actual evidence for. You know, the Boy Scouts who use the sticks to cook marshmallows and all that kind of thing. Those are stories I've been hearing for as long as I've been in business. And we went through an interesting process of that in Davis way back when. They were taking out some oleanders near a pool at a particular, I was going to say country club. It's not a country club. Park or something. And the first story I got was, oh, they're taking out the oleanders. The next story I got was branches from the oleanders were falling in the pool and there was concern about it. And then the next person said that a kid had gone to the hospital. So in the matter of just weeks, it went from they're removing the oleanders to an actual supposed case of poisoning. There was no evidence of that particular case of poisoning. It was just another example of how urban legends grow. So you may have heard of something, but I have actually looked in the literature and found cases of oleander poisoning. As I say, it's rare and hard to do because it's so bitter, you will choke before you'll swallow it. It's really that simple. But if you're an alpaca, apparently you can swallow things that are very bitter, unfortunately. So these are livestock concerns, generally not human concerns.
If I have these young shoots coming up on my oleander, how hard would it be to take one, cut it, root it, and make a second oleander plant? Because it seems like it should be pretty easy.
Very easy, yes. I know an individual in La Jolla, California, who took branches of poinsettia and branches of white oleander and stuck them in the ground 3 feet apart, alternating, and watered them. In La Jolla, poinsettias will root if you do that, as will oleanders. So they created an oleander poinsettia hedge. I wonder if it's still there.
Sounds like a candy cane.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Am I recommending this? No, you don't need to plant oleanders. They're a cool plant, but you know, Caltrans is probably the best. Highways are the best place for them.
Well, if anybody wants one of those white ones, write to us.
No, just go to a nursery and buy one. You can get one from a nursery. You don't have to start a cutting yourself.
Well, yeah, but
we're not a free cycle site. Go to a nursery and spend some money.
All right, go to a nursery.
You know, even better, go to a nursery and buy a plant that's more appropriate to your yard, because the white oleander is huge. It's a very big plant.
It is. Mine was well over 12 feet tall. So every week I ask Don some questions. In the springtime, is it time to plant tomatoes? We've stopped that one. Then it was, is it time to plant peppers? We've stopped that one because it's definitely time to plant just about
You can still plant any of those.
Wait yeah. a minute. Don, is it too late to plant?
It is not too late to plant some of those things. It depends on how many days it is to harvest, and you can look on the label and that'll tell you. And if you're getting into 80 to 90 days, like a melon, It's July. You'd be harvesting in, let's see, the end of September. That's getting a little late for a melon, not because of frost, but just because the days are getting shorter and the quality wouldn't necessarily be there. But you can do them, I suppose, if you want to. There's plenty of things you can still plant from seed, cucumbers, bush beans, corn. You can do one more planting of corn. Those squash, zucchini. You can put in zucchini anytime and be harvesting 4 to 6 weeks later. So these are things you can do from seed. And also, as I've mentioned before, you can start pivoting. It's July. Mid-July, we start planting Brussels sprouts and certain other members of that family. Some people put in collards in mid-July to get as big a plant as possible. Some of the old-fashioned cabbages should go in July or early August. There are modern varieties that develop more quickly, but you want to grow a big old head of cabbage. You do some of the old types and you plant them late July, August into September. So we start pivoting over. I just did my garlic order. For now, to ship to me in late August, early September, you can start planting garlic here in September and all the way into February. So the issue with that one has been availability. The last 4 or 5 years has been terrible. So we're all scrambling to get our orders in and then see what we would actually get. This year it looks pretty good. So I've got a bunch of garlic coming in probably the end of August, early September. You need to think about where these things are going to go. So, in our climate, your tomatoes and peppers will be out there growing and producing through October. And a lot of those winter things should be going in late August or September. So, try to look at how you're going to transition over to the cool season vegetables because we have 2 full seasons of gardening here. We mention it all the time on the air, but in my nursery, we get to talk to people who have just moved to Davis from someplace else, someplace that actually has seasons, a place where winter is a non-active period in the garden, or places like Southern California, where it's pretty much the same all the time, right? At least on the coast. And so they come here and they go, wait a minute, what are you talking about? You plant collards when? Well, we have a very long season, both for cool season vegetables and for warm season vegetables. And the challenging thing is that overlap period when you should be putting in your brassicas, but you still got tomatoes in the way. Take a look around right now. Where are the garlic going to go? Where are your onions going to go in November? But especially, where are you going to start putting in those really important brassicas and rutabagas, which you have to plant in July? If you don't plant rutabagas and Brussels sprouts in July, you're just not going to have good yield. So I think it's important if you want those rutabagas to get them going the middle of this month. Direct seed, you're not going to find plants in garden centers.
Don, you make fun of rutabaga, but it's a
They're
really
great.
good vegetable.
My kid loved them raw. It
I
was
know.
when a toddler child, slice a rutabaga, peel it, put it, cut it into wedges, hand it to him. He'd gnaw on it for ages. Rutabagas are great, by the way, and root vegetables are quite easy to grow if your soil is loose. So perhaps we'll devote some time later in July, early August, to how to grow those all-important root vegetables that are so important to our civilization, like rutabagas and potatoes.
And carrots and radishes.
Yeah, and beets and turnips and all that kind of stuff. Some are easy, some are not. So, but the key with all of them is even moisture and loose soil.
Now we are going to keep you happy, I hope, by lightening us up with a garden quote, as we do most every week. And by the way, I want to thank the Empress of Dirt for several of these garden quotes we've used over the months that we've been doing this. And this one, have you ever seen that little sign that says gardening cheaper than therapy and you get tomatoes? You ever seen that sign? Well, this one has a picture of that sign with the and you get tomatoes crossed off, and it says gardening cheaper than therapy and you get tomatoes until your spouse adds up the receipts.
One of the most common answers we get to, would you like your receipt? Is no, I don't want any evidence. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.